Okay. So at various times, like all the time, I'll try to keep the issues close at hand. And these issues will be sensitivity and noise and crosstalk in the pathways. And we'll be very interested in adaptive regulation of the enzymatic signaling. And we'll be always on the lookout for universal modules in this zoo of enzymatic networks. And I think the modeling discussion will probably happen in the second hour of this morning. And we'll discuss in some detail the universal enzymatic amplifier and its engineering properties. We'll see how to deal with the noise. We'll ask a question of how much gain is enough in the signaling pathway. And then we'll take a close look at regulatory parameters that the cell has at its disposal and can tune in order to achieve desired function. And the last discussion will be on spatial localization, so spatial effects in enzymatic signaling. So, anyway, someone this morning expressed a concern that this is all going to be biochemistry, and I may or may not be an expert in various things that Sebastian mentioned, but I'm certainly not a person to learn biochemistry from. So, in fact, certainly my first encounter with biochemistry was through these wall charts of metabolism that I'm sure you've seen too. And these charts can't really fit on a slide. So here it is in a greatly abbreviated form where each dot corresponds to a metabolic intermediate and each connecting line is a reaction. And so here are some intermediates of these various reactions. So these are basically modifications of carbon chain of complex molecules, which is produced by enzymes. So now if you, this is going to be our 3 minutes worth of biochemistry. If you zoom in on one little, no, actually not here, right here. You will find the beginning of glucose metabolic pathway. And the first step in glucose metabolism is it has to be activated by transfer of phosphate, and this is done by a certain enzyme. So here's a closer blow up of that activation step. So here is this ring compound, the sugar, glucose. And in order to be broken down, it has to be activated. And that happens by transfer of a charge phosphate group, which gets attached here with the help of an enzyme, which happens to be called hexokinase. And the phosphate comes from the high energy compound, ATP. As you know, this is so the metabolic currency of the cell. And since there's going to be a lot of ATP popping in and out in the talk, let me just tell you what it is for a second. Well, ATP is one of the nucleotides that DNA is made of, but it really plays many, many other roles in the cell. And okay, it is made of the base, which is a nitrogen-containing ring. It comes in four flavors, adenine, guanine, cytosine, and thymine. Actually, there is a fifth one too. But anyway, this base is joined to a sugar ring and a phosphate. So this is the charged phosphate group. And in ATP, the T stands for triphosphate. So the beauty of this compound is that more phosphates can be added, and each phosphate carries a nice large negative charge. So in the triphosphate form, it is rather high energy in the sense that these charged phosphate groups are rather readily transferred to whoever else might want them. Like that glucose. And the class of enzymes that carry out, that catalyze phosphate transfer is called the kinase. So there are all kinds of kinases. So, but really for the rest of the talk, all the chemistry for us is going to be a bunch of arrows, and all we'll need to know is how to convert arrows into differential equations. So let's just describe that catalytic reaction in a simple form. And of course, the process isn't really so simple, and we'll need to make immediately some approximations. So you start with an enzyme, and it's going to bind glucose and an ATP. So it's going to form a complex, enzyme, glucose, and ATP. And then in that complex, the catalytic step is going to be the transfer of the phosphate. So it's going to be glucose phosphate now, from ATP. And the ATP will turn into ADP, the diphosphate. And then the enzyme has to release these two molecules. It's going to release glucose phosphate and ADP. And you already see that there are quite a few reactions that are really happening here. So for example, I drew it as if glucose gets attached first and then ATP, but perhaps it's happening in opposite order. So we're going to hide all this and basically say that glucose and ATP together represent the substrate of this enzyme, and glucose phosphate and ADP represent the product. And following Michaelis and Menten, we will sort of describe the whole process as the enzyme plus substrate turns into an enzyme-substrate complex reversibly and rapidly. And then this complex decays into an enzyme and the product. And this step is almost irreversible. And it certainly makes sense in this context at hand. In fact, it's precisely this ATP that makes the process almost irreversible, because ATP and ADP are maintained by the cell far out of equilibrium. So there is a lot of ATP and very little ADP because cell metabolism constantly mops it up. So since these two steps, this one step is in equilibrium, we can just say that the concentration and the right square brackets will denote concentrations. Are related by the equilibrium relation, and right where Km is basically the exponential of the free energy difference between enzyme and substrate separately and together. Right. And then we have to remember that the total amount of enzyme is fixed. And for this irreversible step, we're just going to write down an equation for the rate of production of the product. And that is happening with some rate K. And it's proportional to the concentration of the complex. And now we can...
Boris?
Yes?
So I didn't understand your definition of irreversibility. So irreversibility means the backward rate constant
is very small.
It's much smaller than before?
Yes.
But that's not the same thing as saying that the concentrations of ATP are...
Well, effectively yes, because... The rate of the reverse process is going to depend on concentration of ADP. So if this is if ADP goes into an infinite bottomless sink, right, that would essentially eliminate the possibility for reaction to go backwards. Okay, so we just solve this for the concentration of the complex. So it's the total amount of enzyme over S over the equilibrium constant plus the concentration of the substrate. And we are all done. We've just derived the Michaelis-Menten equation for enzymes. Is that me? Michaelis-Menten for equation for catalytic processes. So what do we have? We have the rate of reaction here times total concentration of the enzyme times concentration of the substrate over Km plus substrate concentration. Okay, so this is basically telling us that at low concentration of the substrate, the rate is proportional to substrate. At high concentration, the rate becomes limited by the availability of the enzyme. And right. Ultimately, of course, the rate of production is proportional to the number of enzymes. Of course, this is derived in somewhat simplifying limit, where substrate is in great excess of the enzyme, but there is no problem in generalizing it at the expense of some awkwardness. So, anyway, this is a biochemistry briefing that you got, and from now on, we'll just have arrows. But this metabolic chart is awfully complex. And to a physicist, at least, it is very tempting to think that it is so complex that it's actually random. And one can ask, actually, a non-trivial, perhaps biologically irrelevant question, but an amusing question, what actually is happening in random chemical networks? So my... Marty Feinberg worked on this, and he gives very amusing talks. And when I heard him talk, he started by pointing out a very, very peculiar fact. If you look at the Journal of Applied Mathematics, it will list all the subjects of applied mathematics, and there is mathematical biology, there is mathematical economics, there is of course mathematical physics, but there is no mathematical chemistry. And his interpretation of that was to say that this is because chemistry is dynamically boring, that chemistry always just relaxes to equilibrium. But and he went on to try to prove it, at least in some generic sense. I mean, we certainly know that there are chemical oscillators, but what he tried to ask was, given some random set of chemical reactions, right? So here are just letters and arrows drawn completely at random. What can you tell about the existence of the steady states? Can you say if there's going to be unique steady state or multiple steady states or what? And so mathematically, of course, it's right, we will just transcribe all these equations into chemical kinetic equations, right? Pretty much like we did on the blackboard, except for we don't even have well-defined enzymes here yet. These are just elementary errors. Hmm? Oh, these are reactions. These are different reactions. So this is B combines with F. No, I'm sorry. This is B combines with D to make F. But yes, you can certainly write this down in an open reactor. You can certainly say that you're just adding one, let's say A, with a fixed rate. So that will be your influx. So that's the general system he considered. And well, clearly there are some conditions under which we know that there is a unique steady state. That is when the system is in equilibrium, and we know that there is free energy, which gets minimized. So it acts as a Lyapunov function, or the functional. More generally, right, we don't really need free energy, we just need a Lyapunov functional. And it can be rather explicitly written down for all the tree networks. It's pretty obvious if there are no loops that there'll be unique steady state. But Feinberg actually proved some completely non-trivial theorems about, above and beyond these trivial cases, he found some very non-trivial cases where he was able to prove the existence of a unique steady state quite independent of all the kinetic constants, only from the topology of this network. So these are two Feinberg's index theorems. So this is very interesting. As so mathematical chemistry aside, but well, he actually I think in one case it is clear that it's stable because he sort of constructs a Lyapunov functional. In another case, it's not at all clear that it's stable. Well, this was an aside. But back to biological reality. Of course, biochemical networks in the cell are not random at all. So we have to study them for what they are. And all we can do is try to divide and conquer. So first we're going to distinguish these metabolic networks that I just showed on the chart, which have to do with so energy and biosynthesis. So if you like, this is the old economy of the cell. And there are other networks which regulate the old economy by doing information processing. And so these information processing networks, right, so first of all, directly control metabolism, for example. Or they control the cell by regulating the gene expression and therefore determining how much of which protein and in particular how much of which enzyme the cell is going to produce. And this again will regulate all cellular processes and including metabolism, rather indirectly. And the last type that we can distinguish is sensory processing. So that really deals with information for its own sake. And perhaps the simplest information processing pathway is that involved in bacterial chemotaxis. So bacteria have a problem that they like to solve. They like to find better life where nutrient concentration is higher. And well, they're able to swim. They have flagella, and they can do two things with this flagella. They can swim more or less straight, or they can sort of fluff their flagella up, and they can make a more or less sharp random turn or tumble. And their trick is to keep on swimming straight if they detect the increase in the concentration of the nutrient, and tumble otherwise. So if they start going in the wrong direction, they tumble more frequently, right, and randomly change direction. But if the life is improving, they just keep going that way. So the way it's done is bacteria have a receptor which gets activated by a ligand that could be any of the attractive nutrient compounds. Actually, bacteria are also sensitive to noxious compounds, and will swim away from high concentration of repeller. So as it happens, the receptor forms a complex with essentially a kinase, which in the absence of a ligand is active. And it inactivates when the ligand binds. So somehow binding of a ligand changes the conformation of a receptor and affects the activity of this receptor kinase complex. And everything, all the proteins here will be called key A or key some other letter, and key stands for chemotactic deficiency in a mutant that was lacking that particular protein. And that has to do with the history of how these proteins were discovered. So the information from the receptor ends up in the flagellar motor. So bacteria have this essentially rotary motor driven by the proton gradient. And this motor can spin in either direction. When the flagella spin one way, well, they're helical, so they'll form a tight bundle, and that causes straight swimming. If the motor turns in the opposite direction, flagella unwind, and that causes a tumble. The probability of turning right or left is biased by interactions with a certain messenger called QY. So this messenger QY lives in two states, can be in two conformations, an inactive conformation and an active conformation. And active receptor activates QY by phosphorylating it. That is, phosphorylation is precisely the step of transferring the phosphate from ATP to, any molecule, QY in the present example. In its active state, this QY will diffuse through the cell and bind to the motor, and make it more likely to cause a tumble. If the ligand binds, receptor switches into inactive state, and there is another enzyme present here, which is always active, and that enzyme just dephosphorylates, that is, deactivates QY. So the concentration of QY drops, and there is no ligand to bind to a rotary motor, and the bacteria is more likely to swim. So this illustrates the two ways that
this seems to just measure the concentration of the ligand, but it doesn't mean that it's getting better or worse. As you mentioned, it makes you swim up a concentration rate.
So right. We'll get there. Okay. So at the moment, this was just the enzymatic machinery. So you see that the fundamental step of signal transduction is this activation-deactivation. And very commonly, this activation will occur by covalent modification with this phosphoryl group transfer. And right, this phosphate is highly charged, and you're not surprised that it can trigger the change in the conformation of the molecule, and it will change its shape and perhaps become active. And so that's what happened in order to activate this KY messenger. The motor, on the other hand, got activated by another common mechanism, by allostery. So again, very often you'll see that the protein is inactive until it binds some ligand, which will make it change the conformation from inactive to active. So we'll see this all the time. So the question got already asked, with all that, how does bacteria find its way? Naively, you think that it wants to measure the spatial gradient of the concentration. But well, bacteria are very small, and it isn't at all obvious that measuring concentration differences at just over that small size of a bacterial cell is a terribly good idea. But another way of estimating the gradient is in the time domain. So just think of a total change in concentration over some relatively short time tau. It's going to be the integral over the trajectory of the bacteria, right? V dot gradient of the concentration. So this is a pretty good proxy for the concentration gradient. And on the other hand, the total change in concentration over some time can be estimated by measuring the time history with a proper kernel that will act like a time derivative. So what you want is a perfect adaptation. You want the kind of response kernel that in response to a step in concentration will produce a purely transient response. So it will only sense the gradient. And then the question is, how does bacteria do it? Well, there is an adaptation mechanism which works in the following way. As I already told you, receptor is active without the ligand, but it turns out that it can be actually in many states of activity, which are determined by the number of methyl groups that are attached to the receptor. So the receptor can be modified by attachment of methyls, and there are two enzymes, KR and KB, which respectively transfer methyl groups onto the receptor or off. And in the methylated form, the receptor is more active. And now if it binds a ligand in an unmethylated form, so here I'm imagining that it shuts off completely. But in the methylated form, the activity will also reduce, but perhaps a little less. So Barkai and Leibler proposed a two-state view of this process. Basically said that the receptor can be either active or inactive, with the probability of being in the active or inactive state dependent on its ligand binding state, depending on whether there is a ligand or not, and on its state of methylation. And then they essentially postulated that demethylation occurs only in the active state, quite independently of whether there is a ligand or not, or whether, you know, how many metals there already are. Having said that, you can derive a simple equation describing the dynamics of methylation. So let M denote the state of methylation of the receptor, and metals are added at a constant rate by the methylating enzyme and are removed by this key B, demethylating enzyme, but only if the receptor is active. So A corresponds to the probability of active conformation, which depends on how many ligands, I'm sorry, whether there is a ligand or not, and how many metals it might have. Looking at it, you immediately see that the steady state, the activation in the steady state, is simply fixed by the ratio of activity of this methylating and demethylating enzymes. And the level of methylation has to adapt to the presence of the probability of a ligand present appropriately. So, to the extent that this methylation variable is essentially an integral of activity, you can think of M as an integral feedback. Integral regulatory feedback into the system. And that is something well known to engineers. This is what an engineer would do in order to design this perfectly adapting system. So, this is plausible. But there are all kinds of other questions that arise.
Yeah, I still don't understand the question. So the level of methylation includes the best. So how does it get rid of the DC then?
Well, what you have is right. This tells you that steady state activation is just pinned to this ratio, right? If it isn't, you're going to add or subtract metals here until it gets pinned.
Depend on But A is a function of L and M of L. So it has a ligand concentration too.
Correct. So level of methylation will adjust, you know, is a function of ligand concentration. So what you want in the system is you want the internal degree of freedom, this level of methylation, to compensate exactly for the changes in the external degrees of freedom. And you know, of course, you know, ultimately, these assumptions cannot.
The output signal is A.
Yeah.
The output signal is A.
Yes. A is the level of activity. So the punchline is that.
A will have transient double hypnosis.
That's right. The punchline is that the level of activity of a receptor will relax to some constant independently, in a steady state, independently of ligand concentration outside. Well, so this bacterial chemotaxis is perhaps really the simplest of these enzymatic signaling systems. But it's remarkable, in fact, how little we still understand about it. There are all kinds of questions. For example, we don't understand terribly well the sensitivity and the dynamic range of the system. It is known that bacteria will behave chemotactically in a very wide range of ligand concentrations, going down to a few nanomolar. And, well, one nanomolar is one molecule per micron cubed. And, well, bacteria is just a few microns. So here you just have a roughly at this lower limit of sensitivity, you have just few molecules per, you know, in the immediate vicinity of the bacteria. And on the other hand, there is a 10 to the 6 range in concentration in which it's supposed to function. On the other hand, the number of receptors is not that large. So for example, for aspartate, which is an amino acid that bacteria will detect. Now there are about 2,000 receptors, and again, it is known, it has been estimated, that the threshold of detection goes down to one over one ligand per 600 receptors. So which amounts to about three receptor ligand complexes. And you may ask, how is this known? Yes? Yes. Yes, absolutely. Yes. So it is exactly that. It's a primitive of action system. And which brings actually a very important and relevant question of how bacteria actually integrates these different stimuli. So we'll return to this in a minute. So how is this known? There are beautiful experiments which was developed in Howard Berg's lab, where a single bacteria, or rather lots of bacteria, are attached by their flagellate tail to a substrate And then in the microscope, you can look at just a single bacteria and measure the rotational bias, how often a bacteria switches the direction of rotation as a function of ligand concentration, which can now be applied in a nicely controlled way. So this is how one measures this threshold of detectability. On the other hand, if one relies on our understanding of biochemistry, and as I said, this bacterial chemotactic system is relatively well understood in the sense that kinetic constants for various enzymes have been measured, and if one just simulates this biochemistry, one will arrive at the estimate of just detectable threshold being 40 times higher than what is observed. And just detectable corresponds to a minimal detectable change in rotational bias, which is about 10%.
This is based on the models that you described?
No, I didn't really go into biochemistry of... this is based on writing down the kinetic equations for this key Y activation and taking the best current model for interactions of this key Y with the motor and.
But you have to use this two-state model for the feedback part of the two-state model, or is there? You described it.
Yeah. No, this. I think this was even done. Right. To estimate this threshold, you really don't need to know everything about perfect adaptation, right? All you need is an estimate the height of the transient spike. So I think that that's sort of all that has been done. And one possibility is that this biochemical estimates are not very good, and but another very plausible scenario is that the receptors don't really act alone. It is known that these receptors tend to cluster on the surface. And Dennis Bray and friends have proposed that within these clusters, receptors share their activation. So binding of a ligand by one receptor will deactivate not only that receptor, but its neighbors. So this is, if you like, contagion of conformation. I guess a similar thing is supposed to happen in prions, but presumably by a completely unrelated mechanism. So Bray's scenario is that in response to a single ligand, you're going to change the state of activation of some largish number of receptors, and then of course you can easily explain the high sensitivity. But there is a problem. The problem is that then you stop understanding the large dynamic range. So you can imagine that just looking at the formation of receptor ligand complex, right, as a function of ligand concentration, and by some appropriate choice of equilibrium constant, you could explain the variation. Let's see. I'm missing something here. Well, you can arrange things so that even at high concentration, when almost all receptors are occupied with ligands, there is still, let's say, 1% or fraction of 1% variation that is detectable. And but if you crank up the gain in activation, this will say that the activation will saturate long before the complex formation. So if you gain on the gain here at small concentrations, you're going to lose on the dynamic range. So Bray's... Yes?
What is the nature of the dynamic range? Is there a logarithmic sensitivity or is
it logarithmic sensitivity or something else? Well,
if you look at the threshold of delta C over C constant, it's C increases.
Yes. That's most certainly true. Yes, that's most certainly true. So, anyway, Bray's solution to this conundrum was to say that perhaps not all the receptors are clustered, and some are not clustered, and therefore continue functioning at small gain, so that at a low ligand concentrations, you'll get the benefit of high gain within these clusters. At high ligand concentrations, the clusters will completely saturate and drop out, and you will recover your low gain receptor component. And another reason why this sort of mechanism is plausible has to do precisely with the existence of different flavor receptors. And some of these receptors are known to occur at very, very low numbers. So if the excitation is actually shared by receptors of different flavor, you could see how some very lonely receptor could still activate the system. But my conundrum with this picture is the following. So we know that bacteria will respond to different stimuli. So it has different flavor receptors. Now, suppose it has two sources in its environment. It has a source of circles and it has a source of squares. So, if all that happens in the schematactic circuit is the addition of the stimuli, then the total gradient that bacteria is going to measure will be directed right in between the sources, and that is not a good survival strategy. So probably bacteria can do a bit more than we understand biochemically now. So you can imagine that this problem would be solved if these different flavor receptors were actually inhibiting each other. Ah, that's actually a good point. That's that's actually a good point. Right. Sebastian pointed out that the same problem with the schematactic strategy will exist even if we have two sources of the same stuff. So
that's just a problem, gradient problem. Eventually, if it goes in that direction enough, then the gradient will point to the
source. Right. So that's right. So the moment the symmetry is broken, you will. Well, the natural stimulus presumably is consists of several gradients, right, of several fields, not necessarily generated by one source. So it's probably not that far off. So anyway, I was just trying to argue that it is conceivable that the simple sort of very naive picture of chemotaxis is not a full story, and we still need to understand how different stimuli interact and how bacteria makes the choices between different factors. Yes. Well, you see, the methylation was necessary to get this perfect adaptation, because you need some internal variable to take up the slack when the external ligand concentration changes. So you need something like that. And
so the methylation pulls away some of the receptors, essentially. Yeah. Takes some of the receptors out of the signal. Right?
Yeah. So back here. You see, if there wasn't different, if receptors could be only in a single state, or rather, I should say, only in two states, ligand bound or not bound, and had different level of activation in two states, right? If the ligand concentration changes, right? That will shift the equilibrium between this active or inactive state, and there's really nothing we can do to recover from the change in the ligand. Now that you have added another state, right, this methylated state with different levels of activity, right, you can compensate for the change in this ligand-bound, non-ligand-bound equilibrium by moving the methylation state, right? By shifting the balance from here to here. Am I making sense? So you're introducing this hidden degree of freedom which can respond to the external degree of freedom. So you need more states.
So receptor would remain too long in isolated two states if they don't have each other modification.
Well, it's just that its activity state would directly depend on a ligand concentration. Right? And you would like to get rid of that direct dependence, right? So, and the only way you can do it is by effectively changing the level of response of that receptor to a given level of ligand.
Why do you want to get rid of this dielectric dependence? You want to measure.
No, you only want to measure transient. You only want to measure it transiently because you really want to measure not the absolute concentration but the gradient in the concentration. Right. So that's really the reason behind it. Yes. 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 Precisely.
Is there a limit in terms of how much your outside concentration can change that you can compensate for the concentration inside state?
Yeah, most certainly. Most certainly.
So is there some comparison or some measurement or something
that could... Yeah, I'm actually not aware of... yes, that, you know, it is clear that perfect adaptation cannot be perfect over an arbitrary wide range of ligands. So I don't know exactly how much quantitative data there is about that. Let's see, I was going to do a bit more.
One more question.
Yes.
You said if a field adjustment force is modified because of the variation of the movement, so if it's high already, it doesn't really work.
Yeah. Well, this is a philosophical question, right? The observation is that, in some range of concentrations, it will adapt. Certainly, right, as got mentioned, there is an upper bound, upper limit of concentration where this response is observed. You can ask, now, which happens to be of the order of a millimolar, so you can ask, does bacteria adapt as perfectly at a millimolar concentration as a micromolar concentration? I can't be quantitative about that.
What about the band ligands?
I'm sorry?
You described that the bacteria wants to go to the source of
yes.
The ligand.
Yes.
Are the band ligands, what is the difference in the transduction of the signal?
I think it's just the opposite, that a repeller activates the receptor rather than deactivate it. So, and because the level of activation is pinned somewhere in mid-range, right? It can be modulated in both directions rather happily. So let's see, what's the schedule like? Is this a good time for a break, or you want to go on for another few minutes?
Natural.
Well, can I stop here, or I can... Well, I'm going to change gears a bit. So we can stop here or we can... Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's go back to business. So I just spent an hour talking about bacteria, and now we're going to switch to a somewhat more sophisticated signaling system that's found in eukaryotes, and starts with the lowly yeast, and then goes on to all other creatures, large and small. And this is, we're going to discuss this very ubiquitous G protein mediated signaling system. So what we have is information flow from external stimuli that could be hormones or olfactory stimuli, or different odors, or taste, or it could be light. I think much of this hour we'll spend discussing the workings of this G protein signaling system in for the transduction in vision. But all in all, I think there are at least 100 examples known of the system. So the information flow is from this stimulus to a receptor to this G protein signaling molecule to the effector enzyme, and this effector enzyme will signal to a variety of downstream pathways. Some will involve this cyclic nucleotide second messenger systems, about which we'll talk in great detail, or calcium, or cascades of kinases. The first such system we characterized was so-called beta adrenergic signaling in muscle cells, and there it is involved in the stress response. So the stress produces adrenaline, secreted in the adrenal gland, and this hormone then activates the beta adrenergic signaling pathway, which in muscles basically kicks muscle cells into overdrive. So it will shift the cell to metabolize glucose faster. G protein signaling takes place on a membrane, or rather, right under the membrane. So here is a receptor for this external ligand acting as a stimulus. And these receptors form, again, a very large class of so-called G-protein coupled receptors, all of them very highly homologous as far as their structure is concerned. There are these seven helix transmembrane receptors. And they have a catalytic domain inside, on the inner side of the membrane, and the receptor on the outside, and they're coupled through the change of conformation of this protein induced by binding the ligand. The G protein lives on the inner side of the membrane. It's attached to it by the tail, and as you've come to expect by now, it comes in inactive conformation and in active conformation. And in its inactive state, it has a GDP. So this is guanosine diphosphate. So this is another one of those nucleotides. It is, for our purposes, an exact analog of ATP, just GTP. And in the active state, the GDP molecule got substituted by GTP, and this nucleotide substitution was catalyzed by the active receptor. So this receptor catalyzes a nucleotide exchange, and remember, GTP again is the more highly charged state of this molecule, and this transfer of GTP causes again a conformational change here, and the alpha subunit of a G protein breaks off of its other two subunits to which it has been docked to in inactive state. Now it breaks loose, it diffuses through diffuses along the membrane, and if it happens to encounter an effector enzyme in its inactive state, it will activate it. So in this beta adrenergic pathway, the effector enzyme is adenyl cyclase, which takes ATP and turns it into cyclic AMP. And these cyclic nucleotides, so again, just a tiny bit of chemistry. These so here's ATP with three phosphates. Adenylate cyclase, I think also sometimes often called adenylyl cyclase, not that I know the difference. But it will cleave off two of the phosphates and form this ester bond, closing a ring with the remaining third phosphate. So this is what cyclic indicates here. So it's yet another state of a nucleotide. And in this intermediate state, okay, so here's the drawing with arrows. So here's this effector enzyme, adenylate cyclase, manufacturing cyclic AMP out of ATP, and cyclic AMP is a ubiquitous second messenger. It is used in all kinds of processes. And this active messenger has to be degraded, otherwise it will be useless, and that is done by another enzyme called phosphodiesterase, which basically cleaves this bond and turns cyclic AMP into AMP. And again, this equilibrium is really maintained by cell metabolism, which actively mops up low phosphate forms of nucleotides and turns them into high energy form.
So what are the energetics then there? So cyclic AMP is?
Intermediate state. It's an intermediate state energetically between ATP and AMP. So both of these processes are downhill. And the power supply comes from cell metabolism, which maintains the high ATP to ADP and AMP ratio. So that was the second messenger cyclic AMP. And Again, if this G protein will stay active forever, it will be quite useless as a signaling molecule. So there is the activation mechanism, which involves the hydrolysis of GTP, which turns then into GDP. And now this G protein effector enzyme complex unbinds, and the inactive G alpha subunit is then mopped up by its docking station G beta gamma. And again, you see that all these signaling processes go, all these activation and deactivation steps go downhill. So we always start with the high energy source, right? So sort of the power supply, GTP, and right, all of these steps, the activation goes downhill energetically, and deactivation is also going downhill. So all we need are the enzymes to carry out these processes. So what happens with the cyclic AMP further down? It activates a cascade of kinases. So first of all, it activates an enzyme called protein kinase A. And well, this is a very sloppy view of the process. If one zooms in a little bit, one will learn that actually this, okay, so let's zoom in on pKa. So it actually consists of four subunits, so two catalytic subunits and two regulatory subunits. And without cyclic AMP bound to regulatory subunits, it's inactive. But when cyclic AMP binds, these regulatory subunits, which are actually inhibitory, they break off. And this enzyme activates. So this is a sort of very common situation, that activation requires not a single allosteric binding event, but in this case, double. So the activation will actually be a nonlinear function. So in this case, a quadratic function of cyclic AMP concentration. So we've activated our protein kinase A, and well, it's a kinase, so it's going to phosphorylate something. It's going to phosphorylate this enzyme called phosphorylase kinase. So it will transfer phosphate to it and turn it from inactive to active conformation. And phosphorylase kinase is going to phosphorylate, guess what? It's going to phosphorylate the phosphorylase. As it happens, it will activate the glycogen phosphorylase, which acts to start glycogen, which is sort of the storage form of glucose. It will start it on its way of glycolysis. And will shift the cell into the mode of glucose metabolism and will basically start burning glucose. Yes. Yeah, so phosphorylase is, it's the glycogen phosphorylase. These are just the names of various enzymes. And, right, so this is the kinase specific to the phosphorylase, right? So it just happens to activate this particular enzyme. Excuse me?
The
of phosphorylase, of glycogen phosphorylase. You know, this gets to be very confusing, and in fact, so this is an example of, you saw the first example of kinase cascade. So here's another kinase cascade, which happens to be involved in mating response in yeast, which also happens to be an example of G protein signaling pathway. But what happens there is you start with, now this is, now yeast can live in two states, in a haploid where they have just one set of chromosomes, a diploid. Haploids come in two flavors, in A, or in two sexes, in A and alpha. And if they detect the presence of the opposite sex, these bachelor yeasts will prepare for mating, which requires stopping their budding cell cycle and turning on the expression of many, many genes which prepare it for mating. So they have to detect the pheromone and start transcribing mating genes. And along the way, so these appropriate transcription factors are activated by a MAP kinase. And the MAP kinase is activated by a MAP kinase kinase, which is activated by a MAP kinase kinase kinase. So I think this at least systematizes the notation. So this is an aside, but returning to that cyclic AMP signaling in cardiac cells, the picture really looks a little more like this, or rather this is still a fragment of the situation that biologists are up against. So you have a receptor, you have this G protein signal which goes to adenyl cyclase, and then there happen to be lots of different forms of this adenyl cyclase. There happen to be several flavors of receptors that signal to it. There happen to be several flavors of G protein which are selective for different receptors and also have different effects on the downstream enzyme. So for example, this G alpha S G protein activates the cyclase, and G alpha I inhibits. And okay, so the cyclase makes the second messenger cyclic AMP, which acts mostly through its friend pKa. But this pKa doesn't just act on this phosphorylase kinase and doesn't just act on metabolism. It acts on all kinds of other things, and it activates some of them, it inhibits some other. And I think the most telling part of this picture is this box which says many others. And but you know, in particular, it acts on ion channels, and signaling like this parallels what happens in neurons and the mechanism which underlies response to opiates, which also go through a G protein and the cyclase and this cyclic AMP, PKA, and then modulation of ionic channels in neurons. So that's direct connection with neuroscience. But the purpose of showing you this picture is to ask a question. How does one begin to deal with complex systems like that? I guess it must be said that this still sort of looks like a tree structure, but there are actually loops here, because you see there are various feedbacks from, I guess the same PKA, but there are other sort of calcium-dependent feedbacks acting here. So it's certainly not a tree structure. There is an alliance. There is a multi-lab cooperative that is just nucleated a year ago, called Alliance for Cell Signaling. And these people collectively are undertaking the task of enumerating all the signaling molecules in two cell types. So they're particularly, for medical reasons, they're interested in this cardiac myocyte and in B lymphocyte. But they believe that they'll be able to identify and characterize every molecule in the signaling universe. And then the next question is, very well, so what are we going to do with all that? And one view is, we can write a program which will turn every arrow on a picture like that into a differential equation, and we're going to simulate it all. And the first problem, of course, that comes up is before a computer can simulate anything, you'll have to supply the kinetic constants for each and every line. So that's going to be pretty hard to measure. But even if you have measured it, how reliable is your measurement? And what exactly are you going to learn from this giant simulation for some particular choice of parameters? So, excuse me? It's not so giant, but so in fact, in that sense, there is hope. I guess Sidney Brenner, I'm going to sloppily paraphrase his argument. So his estimate goes roughly like this. So let's say there are 30,000 genes in a reasonably complex organism. Let's say 10% of these genes are involved in signaling, 3,000. And let's say each signaling pathway is order of 10 molecules. Well, we're down to 300. So all we have to do is construct a catalog of 300 pathways, and not all of them. At the moment, it's if you haven't seen this stuff before, today I'm sort of swamping you with these very different looking pathways and lots of different names, but this sort of argument indicates that perhaps the saturation is not that far off the horizon. and you know, very, very rapidly, you know, already today, you're going to see that certain bits and pieces of these pathways recur again and again and again. So they'll start looking familiar, and maybe ultimately, all we have to do, instead of simulating some very unwieldy large system, is break it up into little blocks or modules, and understand how these modules work, and then we'll be able to mix and match and put them together. Well, that's well, you know, that's an excellent question. You know, unfortunately, for you know, technical and sociological reasons, you know, a given lab very often looks at a particular pathway, right? A particular response to a particular stimulus. So, you know, it is particularly amusing in the context of yeast. So there is this mating pathway, but it so happens that there are, I think, either five or six other MAP kinase pathways which coexist with this one, and they respond to different stimuli. And the valid question arises, well, you can study, under some artificial conditions, you can study these pathways separately, but in the cell they coexist. So how do they avoid crosstalking to each other? Or maybe, on the contrary, this crosstalk is not a spurious thing to be avoided. Maybe this crosstalk is really computation. This is the way how a cell is going to coordinate its various activities. But you know, here the conundrum is rather striking, because there happens to be another pathway which responds to nitrogen starvation by you know, turning on some different set of genes, and that pathway literally involves same MAP kinase pathway. So, you know, one plausible scenario is that if those pathways are really non-interacting, then they're probably spatially segregated somehow, and that is not terribly well understood. But certainly, understanding the integration of the stimuli is the interesting problem that we don't know very much about. You know, we already posed this question with bacteria. Now, how do bacteria integrate, you know, different stimuli? Okay. Let me move on to vision. So, from this introduction, we can articulate you know, a few questions. You know, we would like to understand, you know, what sort of considerations, you know, an engineer would put in into designing a signaling network like this. And on the other hand, we would like to come up with some quantitative tools that our biology friends can use in the task of dissecting these complex pathways. So we want to identify some universal building blocks of signaling, should they exist. We want to understand what engineering requirements, what functional requirements there are on these pathways, and what sort of tuning parameters are available to the cell to achieve the desired response. So for the rest of this hour, I'll be talking about further transduction in the rod cells of the retina. And the reasons that make it a good system to discuss are several. So first of all, it is quite representative on the biochemical level. You will recognize lots of bits and pieces. And it is uniquely convenient in the lab because the input to rod cells is light and the output is voltage. So so here's the schematic picture of the retina, and that's where rod and cone cells live. And curiously, the light actually comes in through this transparent layer of neurons. And the rods and cones are going to absorb light, change their membrane potential, and modulate their neurotransmitter release and signaling to these bipolar and horizontal cells in the retina. So curiously, in the dark, the retinal rods and cones are depolarized, and the light flash causes a transient repolarization. So the time scale is a second, give or take. It's a little faster in mammals and well, about a second in amphibians. And that's where experimentalists like to work. So, as you know, cones are specialized for daylight vision and color vision. And
the time scale is the same as rods and cones?
Cones are a bit faster. So rods see in the dark, and the onset of vision actually corresponds to much less than a single photon per rod per second. So the onset of vision really is not a single cell property. It's a retinal property, and the retina integrates inputs from, well, what, over 1,000 cells. So single cell really kicks in somewhere around here, but still has, well, something like three orders of magnitude of intensity for its dynamic range. And cones start start here. And their dynamic range is actually higher than the single cell dynamic range of a rod. So this comes from psychophysics. You know, the curious thing is, right, this light intensity. Millions. There are more rods than cones. In reading this, I learned that the unit of light intensity used in psychophysics is a scotopic trolland. So, in case you didn't know. So, unfortunately, I can't tell you what it is. Once it got converted, it got forgotten too. So the merits of a single cell, a single rod, the following. They are sensitive to the extent that they reproducibly respond to single photons. So this is the current recorded in patch clamp on a single rod. and you see these 1 picoamp blips coincident with dim flashes. And the rod is able to adapt over relatively wide dynamic range. So in response to a step, right, the voltage will produce a transient drop, right, this is repolarization, but then the response will sag, right? So the response will not completely, like in bacteria, but partially adapt to the step. So the rods are not just sensitive to changes in light intensity. They certainly measure the intensity of the steady light. But they will partially desynthesize. So the response to a weak flash depends on the background. And what you see here is log of this transient repolarization voltage in response to a flash of intensity delta I. And these different curves correspond to different background intensities. And you see that at higher background response to the same brief stimulus is weaker. And this desensitization roughly is inversely proportional to the background intensity. So it's called Weber law. So this was psychophysics, largely. Well, no, I guess psychophysics and electrophysiology. And now we get into the hardware, rather wetware, of the cell. So the rod cell looks like a rod, and it has this very large outer segment, which consists of these membranous discs stacked on top of each other densely. There is this stack of a couple thousand discs here. And that's where light receptor protein lives and all the signaling enzymes. And the currents, and therefore the voltage, is controlled by opening and closing of sodium channels in this outer segment. So the current flows into the outer segment and comes out of the inner segment. This is called the inner segment, as a potassium current. And then, of course, there is sodium-potassium pumps in here, which maintain the chemical equilibrium. Right. So finally, the coupling to the synaptic terminal is through the membrane potential, right? And that membrane potential here will modulate the secretion of neurotransmitter vesicles. Now, zooming in further on this molecular wetware, we're going to see, by now, familiar players. Okay. We talked about the cyclic AMP as a second messenger. Here, the second messenger is cyclic GMP, right? The first cousin of cyclic AMP. And In the rod, it is produced by guanylyl cyclase, right? That's the cousin of adenylyl cyclase that we had before, and it is made out of GTP. So the cyclic GMP is made by the cyclase, and it is digested by a phosphodiesterase, which lives on the discs. And in its inactive state, actually, phosphodiesterase has some remnant enzymatic activity. So each molecule is only weakly active, but then there are really lots of them. So in the dark, this establishes some relatively high concentration of cyclic GMP, and the cyclic GMP binds a nucleotide-gated channel, predominantly sodium channel, and this regulation is cooperative. It takes three cyclic GMP molecules to keep the channel open. Okay, so channels are open, and the cell is relatively depolarized, and the light transducing machinery, which consists of rhodopsin, the photoreceptor molecule, and the trimeric G protein, are at the moment inactive. Now the light comes in, and the receptor rhodopsin, did I already tell you that the receptor molecule is called rhodopsin? So rhodopsin, if it absorbs a photon, it will undergo conformational change and catalyze the nucleotide exchange on the G protein. So this G protein, this G alpha complex, when GTP bound, is going to break off and disinhibit the phosphodiesterase. And phosphodiesterase is going to accelerate the breakdown of cyclic GMP. So cyclic GMP is going to, level of cyclic GMP is going to drop. And that is going to cause the closure of channels. So my collaborator, Anirvan Sengupta, has a nicer way of explaining this. And in many ways, it's more anatomically correct or biologically correct than my picture. So you see, the rhodopsin is the seven helix transmembrane protein, and right, it's going to liberate a very sad inactive alpha subunit of a G protein, which is going to grab phosphodiesterase by the tail and make it digest, gobble up these cyclic GMP messengers that have been keeping the gates open. So, unfortunately, this is only part of the picture, because I just explained how things get activated, but I didn't explain how things get deactivated. So I realized that I had the view graph of impossible complexity explaining it, so instead I'll just scribble on the blackboard. So we have to deactivate everything. We have to deactivate this active rhodopsin, and that occurs in at least two steps. So first it gets phosphorylated, by an enzyme aptly called rhodopsin kinase. And then in the phosphorylated form, it's going to bind another protein called arrestin. Which will completely quench its rhodopsin's enzymatic activity. So then we have to deactivate the G protein, or rather this GTP bearing alpha subunit, and that happens by hydrolysis of this GTP, so phosphate will come off, and GDP bound form of a G protein is inactive, and then it's going to be mopped up by its beta gamma subunits. And come back into its inactive form. So,
okay, let's see what else there are.
Right. And then we want to recover the cyclic GMP level. And that, of course, that, of course, occurs simply by synthesizing more cyclic GMP through this guanylyl cyclase. And then there is feedback. And the feedback is calcium. So somewhere on my awful picture, it said that open channels, along with sodium, which carries most of electric current, they let in calcium. And calcium is pumped out by an exchanger, so it's exchanged for sodium. So there is some balance between the influx and this exchange in the dark. And that keeps calcium level relatively high. Now, when the channels close as a result of light, the calcium influx is cut off, and but the pump is still pumping at full speed, and so calcium is going to drop. And now it turns out that essentially all, or at least most of these deactivation steps are coupled to calcium. So, for example, calcium inhibits rhodopsin kinase, and calcium inhibits guanylyl cyclase. So, in the dark, calcium is high, and these enzymes are relatively inactive. But when the light comes on, calcium drops, the inhibition disappears, and these enzymes kick into overdrive and speed up the deactivation and recovery. So that's one mechanism that you can immediately see is going to help the cell to recover from its depolarization in response to a steady light. Well, after getting into all this complexity, it's time to make things simpler. So, a very simple-minded view of photo transduction is the textbook amplification cascade. So you have a single photon coming in and activating one rhodopsin molecule. Well, that becomes an active enzyme, and it in turn can act on many G proteins, and it's going to activate roughly 500 of them. And the G protein binds to phosphodiesterase stoichiometrically, so there is no amplification in this step. But phosphodiesterase itself now is an enzyme, and it's going to chew up lots of cyclic GMP molecules. And so far we can rather meaningfully talk about amplification, right? We just turned a single molecule into some largish number of activated molecules. But the later stage of this chart become rather confusing, because so some number of channels will close, and some number of sodium ions will be prevented from entering the cell. But you may ask, is this a large number or is this a small number? So we certainly don't think that the gain of the system is 10 to the 7. So one will have to be a little bit more careful about defining the gain. But before we talk about the gain, let's identify our amplifier modules. And these modules are really very simple. You can abstract from this whole picture two stages. There is one stage having to do with G protein mediated stage on disk membrane, and this G protein is activated by nucleotide exchange through action, catalytic action of rhodopsin, and it is eventually deactivated by hydrolysis. And I neglected to say that this hydrolysis is catalyzed by phosphodiesterase itself. And in the second stage, we have this cyclic nucleotide loop. Again, cyclic nucleotide is synthesized by an enzyme, mineral cyclase. It is destroyed by another enzyme, and the loop is closed by cell metabolism. And it doesn't take much to recognize that these are just small variations on the same tune. But what you have is, quite generically, the push-pull module, where you have a messenger that can be in an active and inactive state, and there are two enzymes activating and deactivating it. And both reactions are essentially irreversible because they're coupled to sources of metabolic energy. So let's analyze this simple amplifier to death. So generic push-pull amplifier. So here's our activation, deactivation loop, driven by an activating enzyme and by a deactivating enzyme. And we're going to write down some chemical kinetic equation for the concentration of the active messenger, say this activated G protein, and we can describe both of these enzymatic processes by Michaelis-Menten kinetics. So the activation rate will be proportional to the concentration of the activating enzyme and the concentration of the substrate. And then we have the substrate saturation. And so this is the activation step, and similarly for the deactivation step. So now KD, concentration of deactivating enzyme, concentration of active messenger, and saturation. And and then, of course, the total amount of messenger, inactive plus active, is conserved. So there is some total messenger concentration. And all the dependence on ATP or GTP is in this form hidden in these kinetic constants. But the consequence of this coupling is justification for the irreversibility of these reactions. And that's very important because, well, just to simplify the arithmetic on the blackboard, let's forget about the saturation effect. So let's say that X total is actually much smaller than is Michaelis constants. So we don't have to worry about the denominators. And then the ratio, so steady state. The ratio of active to inactive concentration in the steady state is just proportional to the ratio of, activating enzyme concentration to deactivating enzyme concentration with appropriate constants here. KD, big KD. And, well, this is, of course, what you would hope for, that you can control the concentration of active messenger by fiddling about with the enzyme concentration. But you have to realize that this is a consequence of irreversibility, that in equilibrium, of course, the ratio of active to inactive would be given by thermodynamics, and you would have no ability to tweak that ratio by tweaking the enzymes. So this is why you need the power supply. And you can estimate power dissipation well, it's just the free energy difference between what did I say, GTP and GDP, right? So every time messenger goes around the loop here, it burns delta F difference in energy. And then we just have basically the total rate with which we go around the loop, K over K A. And strictly speaking, if you're doing this in, if you're computing power dissipation for the whole cell, and you have to integrate it over the volume. So let's say that everything's homogeneous for a moment, and there'll be a volume factor. So the next thing, you want to do is define the gain. So let's just do it in linear response. So let's just linearize that equation. And I'll look for the fluctuations in the concentration of active messenger, you know, fluctuations about that steady state that we found. And you know, just laboriously linearizing that, you'll find k over k capital A, a steady state concentration times the change in the enzyme activity. And again, for simplicity, let's say that the input is through activating enzyme. Right. And then that is going to be essentially the time constant, which depends on enzyme concentrations, like this. So what I've done here is I just remembered that right, the total concentration is conserved, so we can express the inactive fraction in terms of the active fraction, and that will give us I guess this term, and then linearizing this term will produce the second contribution here. So this is all in the steady state. So the linear response, so we have a trivial linear equation to solve, which you can do in the Fourier space, delta EA omega. And let's see, we have a numerator, KA, KA, X bar, and I omega from the time derivative. And let me call this whole beast the inverse time constant. And that's it. And let me, just for laughs, rewrite this with a time constant upstairs. In this form, and make the following observation, that at zero frequency, our numerator gives us the static gain. So our static gain, well, we'll call this a frequency-dependent gain. Our static gain is tau Ka over big K X. And what we see is the following. Of course, this was derived under the approximation that this X bar was not too large. If we redo this in saturation, we'll find that basically this, that the gain under those conditions will right, will be limited. But so I guess what I'm trying to say is we cannot achieve arbitrary high gain here simply by increasing the concentration of the messenger. But another vaguely amusing remark here is engineers talk about gain bandwidth quasi theorem, which is a statement that in any engineering system, the frequency integral over the gain appears to be bounded. So for us here, right, the bandwidth is set by this time constant, or rather inverse time constant. So this is time inverse, tau inverse, g of zero. And that is, right, we had time constant here. It just dropped out. So this is just set by kinetic constants. And in fact, is bounded by, well, I guess this is what's called enzyme velocity. So, not surprising. This is just saying that in order to achieve the high gain, with in the reaction with this limited rate, you have to wait for a long time because the enzyme is processive. It is activating one molecule at a time. So if you want to activate a large number of molecules, you'll have to be patient. If you're not patient, you can try to hook things up into a cascade. So let's say that this activated messenger was not just a messenger, but was also an enzyme. And it's going to activate another messenger, or better yet, another enzyme, which is going to activate I guess I got them wrong. Well, actually, it doesn't matter. Which is going to activate the third one. So clearly, the gains of these stages are multiplicative. But the time constants are actually not multiplicative, but additive. So if you estimate the time constant for this cascade, it's going to be dominated by the slowest one of these processes. So now, if you want to maximize the bandwidth with fixed overall gain, right, we'll just fix the product constant and vary with respect to these different time constants. Not surprisingly, you'll find the best you can do is to match all the time constants. And let's see, so I guess tau over square root of N. Okay. Well, let me just, next time I'll write a little bigger. So, anyway, you can, this is a little homework assignment that you can do on the beach. Convince yourself that maximizing the bandwidth under the constraint of fixed gain will require you to match time constants of different stages. Well, you know, this is just trying the best to define the bandwidth. We were just going to define it asymptotically at long times, right, at small omega. Right. So this is just, if you like, okay. Right, so you want actually to just look at the total power. Modulus G squared is the relevant thing to look at. So you're really taking a product of 1 plus omega squared tau squared. Right. And then you'll expand at low omega. So that's sort of one way of defining a time constant.
We said that this will speed up the response faster. What was the point of the cascade? I lost that.
Oh, well, sorry. The point is. Well, it's just a way of increasing the gain, right, without increasing the time constant. Right. Because in the single stage, the gain was limited, or rather, gain bandwidth was limited. Well, yes. So you know the arrow is right here. So you know this is a little tricky because in this particular case, you know, this deactivating enzyme happens to be just the complex of G and phosphodiesterase itself, right? But this PD star is really complex of phosphodiesterase with a G, right? But and it will certainly work out that way, but it's even more transparent, you know, just think as this kinase cascade. So then it's very it's very directly cascade. But here it may not quite look the same, but it actually does. Arithmetically it does, but it's just a little bit less transparent. Okay, another thing that we are interested in are the fluctuations. So one view of the fluctuations is let's see, I guess I can erase this. So one view is sort of completely give up on this chemical kinetics description of the process, and actually erase it. And go over to a master equation description. So, suppose you have, I'm going to explain this using even simple example. So suppose you have some simple bimolecular reaction, A plus B makes C, and let's say that P is the probability of having N molecules of A, N sub B molecules of B, etc. And the time evolution of this joint probability distribution is going to be governed by the master equation, which says that, there is some probability that A will meet B, and form C, right, which occurs with rate k. So there's a chance that we're going to lose one state here. And that actually goes as k n a n b. And we should, right, if they're total numbers, we should divide this by the volume. And on the other hand, there is another term which comes from the state where there were one more molecules of A and B each, and one less molecule of C. To turn off the calcium inhibition here. And that occurs, I guess, with the same, not quite the same rate. K over B, and A plus 1, and B plus 1. Yes?
So where are you heading with this master equation?
I want to describe the fluctuations in concentrations or numbers of molecules. And I'm sorry? Let's see. I don't think so, because the probability should go as the number of molecules to undergo the transition times the concentration of the molecule that is going to meet up. Yeah. So now, if you calculate, fine. So this probability is happily conserved, right? Because if we're going to sum over all n's, these two terms, which are just shifted by one, are going to happily cancel. And on the other hand, if we calculate, to calculate what happens to concentration of A, right, we have to sum on A, sum on everybody, A, B, and C, with N, A, P, and A, and B, and C. And again, this is a homework exercise. If you push this through, you will discover that all kinds of terms cancel here, and well, let's see. Concentration, so I guess I divide it by another volume. And you'll recover your kinetic equation. I'm sorry, yeah, the chemical kinetic equation. But so similarly, you can calculate So this was average, now this was statistical average over the concentration. So now let's calculate the statistical average over just the number of A molecules. And let's see, no, I think to make it a little more transparent, let's do it for a number of C molecules. And you'll find that it's given by the time derivative of this average number squared plus the time derivative of the average number. And that is just a reaffirmation of Poisson statistics. Right. So if we integrate that, we'll just find that delta C squared is equal to the average C. Now, so this is the time integral. So this is the statement that the variance in the number of molecules produced in the reaction over some fixed time is proportional to the number of molecules. So this is just the Poisson statistics recovered. I'm sorry, I, excuse me? Wait. So at the moment there is no feedback. It's just the simplest irreversible reaction. So all that's happening is there is the fixed probability of forming a complex per unit time, right? And we have committed ourselves to this Poisson statistics the moment we wrote down the master equation. So I'm sorry, I realized that you know, filling in the details here would take us too far towards lunch. So,
C is actually the number of moles of C.
Yes.
So
yes, sorry, this was in the interest of speed. Okay, so but do we really have to work quite so hard? Now, this master equation is needed when we really want to describe the joint probability distribution, and that we would worry is important when numbers of all of these molecules are really very small. But in most cases, you'll be in a situation where in the relevant correlation volume, you have lots of molecules, and you can have a simpler description of fluctuations on the level of the second moment that you can derive by assuming that the fluctuations of concentration are small and Gaussian. Right, and of course Gaussianity will come to you from the central limit theorem. So another simpler approach to describing the fluctuations is Langevin equation. And what we're going to do is just take our friendly chemical kinetics and well, let's for full generality remember that molecules diffuse, and we're going to add a Langevin noise term. So this is some random Gaussian field with the following property, that eta r of t correlated with eta at a different point, different time, is white in time and in space. And its variance is just a reaction rate. I'm sorry? No, that's true. Well, if you like, we'll forget about it here too. But we may as well include it here virtually at no cost. We would have to do more work to get it in the full master equation, right? But here it will do us no harm, because Yes. But again, just to simplify this, think of A and B as I realize what I have done. I really wanted to simplify this. But I neglected to tell you the most important thing. Okay, so this is how you would do it in general. But for simplicity, think of now A and B as non-fluctuating. Let's say that they're just fixed in the buffer, and only worry about really fluctuations of of C. So what I really should have written down was just the equation in terms of C only, and right then we'll just say that there's some rate goes as A B or V and C, and that P and C minus 1. And now I understand why it took me so long and why I couldn't get through it. This is really enough for us to make his point. We don't have to handle it in full generality, right? So right, I can just do this. And have I done it this way from the very beginning, I would have been able to walk you through the derivation rather than assign it as a homework. So anyway, so let's keep on just worrying about about the fluctuations of C. So there is some fixed rate with which they are produced, and if that rate happens to be time dependent, we're going to do the calculation on the time scale slow compared to the variation here. And how did we set the variance of a Langevin field? Just by fudging it so as to reproduce the Poisson statistics. So what we want is that the volume integral of the C molecule produced during some period of observation obeys Poisson statistics, right? So we want to, right? So this is the total number of molecule A that has been generated in your reactor. You want to square it and average and let's see, and I guess you want to subtract from it the square of the average, which will get rid of this term. So I may as well put in a delta here indicating that we're looking at the fluctuations. Right, and then we have this dr, dr prime, dt, dt prime, of the eta-eta correlator, which is going to, right, so now we have to integrate twice over this delta function, so we're going to get a volume and the total time times this rate. And that, of course, is just the average number of molecules that got produced during that time in that volume. So anyway.
So inside the square, should that be dt or?
Inside the square. No. Let's just integrate. Let's integrate this equation.
So you have integral of 0 to t dt.
Right.
Inside the angle brackets.
Yes.
You have an integral, right? So isn't that the integral of the derivative?
Integral of the derivative. Yes. I'm sorry. Yes. This is the integral of the derivative. Yes. Yes. I'm sorry. So that's the total number of molecule C produced in that.
So you're trying to derive the same result, delta C squared equals average C from the Langevin.
Yeah. So which we can do by appropriately fudging the variance of the Langevin noise.
So the noise is multiplicative.
Well, additive. I mean, the noise here is additive. So anyway. So it is this Langevin equation approach that suffices perfectly fine to describe fluctuations in. Right. So diffusion. Right. So diffusion. Diffusion term has disappeared because it's a surface term. So, right. No, it's the other way around.
But is there a rigorous derivation? I mean, if you have.
Well, I mean, there is a rigorous derivation in the sense that in the limit of large numbers, and in fact, it has to be a large number per correlation volume, and this is where the diffusion term is important, right? Because this diffusion term sets the correlation volume. There is some characteristic time of reaction, right? Basically our time constant in a reaction that's going to set the length. And what you need to be in the Langevin limit is a concentration sufficiently high that the number of molecules per correlation volume is sufficiently large, right? And then in the master equation, you will just do so the first correction to the mean field, and you know, treat the fluctuations about the means on you know, perturbatively in the Gaussian approximation. So that's the limit in which is valid. And you know, there are clearly situations in the cell where the numbers are really small. That happens more often in the context of transcription control, you know, inside the nucleus, where there's a very small number of transcription factors, and they're basically one place on DNA that they're going to interact with, and it's less of a concern when you deal with signaling, and certainly in visual transduction, where the numbers of enzymes actually happen to be very high. So there it is certainly an adequate approximation. I think I really should stop now and maybe continue for another half an hour after lunch.
Okay, so let's meet back here at 2 o'clock.